From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Sometimes it seems like our economy isn't set up to be earth-friendly. In a world where low prices lead the way, exactly what makes clothes or food so cheap may be hazardous to our health. So the next time you're cutting coupons, it might be good to remember that what you're buying for cheap now may cost later. To talk about the cost of a greener planet, we've got economist and president of Bennett College, Julianne Malveaux. How you doing?
I'm good. Yourself?
I'm doing great. So, you know, nobody wants to spend a lot of money on the basics. When it comes to the issues of buying groceries, buying things for the home, do people really take into account the environment?
It depends on where they are on the income stream, Farai. If they have more disposable income, I think that these green issues become more important to them. People talk about them. People look at the long run versus the short run, and even look at some of the health effects in terms of what kind of additives are being added to food and how healthy those things are, chemicals and other things. But I think if you're looking at people with very basic incomes, when you raise a question, if you say organically produced chicken costs 50% more, and you're a single mom, forget about it. If you say that produce that is organic is going to be another 20, 30 cents a pound, even though you may wonder about the additives, you still may say forget about it. If you can't see the difference and you don't know the difference and education isn't being done, but even more than that, when so-called healthy products are less affordable, those who are fiscally challenged are going to take a pass on them.
And if you go into a lot of grocery stores, especially ones in lower income neighborhoods or even, you know, some middle class neighborhoods, you don't even have the option of a lot of organic goods.
Well, that's another issue. I mean, if you look at many inner cities, you don't even have grocery stores. You have the little mom and pops on the corner. So just getting produce, have you ever walked into one of those hood stores where, you know, the ratio of pork rinds to fresh fruit is like 500 to 1? So, you know, those aren't even options there. You look at the places like a Whole Foods or a Harris Teeter's, where are they? They're in the suburbs, not in the inner cities often. And even when they are close to inner cities, you know, are they near bus lines or things like that? So all kinds of issues of accessibility that come along with the issues of affordability.
What there are, though, are people trying to come up with different solutions. One of the things we've covered on News and Notes are urban farmers markets that try to go into neighborhoods where there's, you know, there's not a lot of money, and often there are people of different ethnicities. Like in L.A., you'll find Latin American and Mexican immigrants along with American-born black folks. And they try to say, okay, let's have a farmers market where we can have the fresh cactus, and we can have eggs, and we can have things that appeal to different markets. Are things like that making a difference?
I think they do make a small difference, but when you look at those places, the volume and the variety, you know, maybe people are buying them for some supplemental things. They're not going to be the places where people take care of their basic food needs. Increasingly, sometimes they can be. When you look at some of the urban farmers markets and people from surrounding areas who decide that they can get a better deal by selling their apples or their lettuce or, you know, their other produce downtown as opposed to through a vendor into a supermarket. You get some increased options. You think about Eastern Market in Washington, D.C., or, you know, downtown San Francisco, or so many other places. There are possibilities. There are few, and there are options that need to be encouraged.
Let's move from food to some of the other issues. When it comes to things like oil and gasoline, heating oil, natural gas, cars, is there anything that's going on that might broaden the eco-consciousness of the Prius crowd to people who might not have Prius money?
You know, one of the interesting things about gas and heating oil and all of those things is that they're somewhat subsidized. We're not paying real cost in terms of the damage that these things do to the environment, in terms of the long-term cost. Now, I know someone's listening and saying, subsidize, give me a break. I mean, after all, when you look at gasoline prices today, they don't look subsidized at all. But compare those prices to prices in other parts of the world. If you go to the Caribbean, if you go to Western Europe, you see gasoline prices that are higher than ours because people are allowing for the environmental damage. We don't allow for that damage, which is why when you have a choice between getting on the subway and jumping in your car, often you jump in your car, you think it's cheaper, it's easier, but it's only cheaper because of the subsidy. We have to begin to have conversations about energy efficiency. We have had some, but it frightens me, Farai, to think that the I think it was 1974, 73, 74, 75, when we had those great lines around corners as people tried to buy gasoline because we were having a gasoline shortage. And at that point, the auto industry pledged that they would do more to make sure we were more energy efficient. And that lasted for about a minute. And episodically, we'll see this energy efficiency. But by and large, we're still doing the SUV gas guzzler thing, and diesel fuel, which is sometimes more efficient and more energy conscious, is something that's the minority. So we collectively haven't done the things with incentives, et cetera, to make it make us more fuel efficient and environmentally friendly. And if that's an issue for all Americans, I think that people at the bottom, again, of the income stream are buying old cars as opposed to new cars because that's what they can afford. Don't care about the issue of efficiency. They just want to get to work.
What about for people who have money, though? There's plenty of black folks, plenty of urban folks, if I can use that term, who have money. And there was a certain cachet, for example, I'll bring up the Prius again, when that hybrid car first came out. Gwyneth Paltrow had a Prius and all these celebrities, I think mainly or almost exclusively white celebrities, were buying these cars. Is there a cachet to being green in the African-American communities?
I don't think so. I think you have people like Carl Anthony and others who looked at the issues of environmental justice and talked about how to be green, but I don't think that it's been a widespread movement. I don't think you can point to an African-American celebrity who's made the issue of a green environment their issue. There's so many other issues that we have to deal with, but let's be clear. There is such a thing as environmental racism. There are places where we bear the brunt of environmental disrespect, such as the way that dumping occurs in places that are very contiguous to inner city neighborhoods. And we should take some lead on this as well. This is not a, quote, white issue. It's not a majority issue. It's a human issue to take care of our environment. It's the only planet that we have.
Whose responsibility is it to address these issues? Should it be government? Should it be each one of us doing what little we can? Should it be private industry?
Well, it's real always with issues like this, it's a combination. Certainly government can set the tone, heighten awareness, and even with tax credits and other things, make sure that those people who do the right thing get a tax break for it. But government can't do it alone, and increasingly we've seen a reluctance to rely on government for everything. So private industry plays a role. Those people who are green manufacturers, I think, have the possibility of carving out a niche of the market and at some point seeing consumer support shift to them. So industry has a role. And then all of us do, of course. It's our planet. And one of the things that I find interesting is that some of our schools, elementary and secondary schools, are having conversations with our young people about the environment. So that a child very recently, a little boy about 8, told me that I shouldn't drink bottled water because it was ruining the environment. I thought that was really cute. I said, where'd you learn that? Learned it at school, that the plastics are something that we can't continue to dispose of without having some consequences. So we need to have environmental conversations that say actions have consequences.
When you think about all the different things that have consequences, like having unprotected sex, et cetera, sometimes we're not so good at the long range, big picture. We make decisions on a very ad hoc, moment-to-moment basis. That's human nature sometimes. What could, I guess it's a personal choice. How do you process that, Julianne, when you take into account behavior as an economist and how much that affects what people do?
I think that one of the things we look at is the way that people market decisions and market issues so that they become more popular. Think about the fact that maybe 40 years ago, 30 years ago, before the evolution of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, you had people who thought that drinking and driving was just okay. And through a concentrated campaign that started from the grassroots and then got government buy-in, the laws have completely changed. Wonder if someone could combine that kind of grassroots with government support to get us more environmentally conscious. Part of the challenge is that a lot of people don't believe that we have an environmental problem. You've got people like Al Gore who've done great work around global warming and other things. And I hope that former Vice President Gore takes the cachet he got from the Nobel Prize and uses it to talk about the environment in more micro ways. But the whole thing is changing people's mindsets, which takes a very long time. It takes committed people, it takes concentrated effort, and it does take government and industry buy-in.
Do you think that things that are very grassroots will make a difference? I'm thinking of a couple of the guests that we've had on. There's Van Jones, who started a green jobs program in Oakland. There's also Sustainable South Bronx, an organization started by a sister that aims to green the ghetto. Do you think that when people see change on the local level, it will make them change?
Oh, absolutely. As people see differences in the Oakland Project, the South Bronx Project, they catch on. I mean, one of the great things about activism as we know it is that these activists, especially in the internet age, talk to each other. And as they talk to each other and share their programs and develop best practices and get young people involved, I think the possibility for some contagion around these programs exists. But I think that, again, I don't think that very many people quite get it, and I don't think that you have yet the impetus, the move to get this to pick up. And there's so many aspects when you talk about green and the environment. We've talked about food. We can talk about energy. We can talk about clothing and how clothing is manufactured. We can talk about, you know, solar panels and all those things. There are lots of aspects to it. We're waiting, I think, for a green manifesto. We're waiting for someone to write that book for RAG or, you know, put together that 30-second soundbite that really makes people say, yes, this is something that I really want to buy into. From an economic perspective, the economy follows the cues that people put out there. We don't have a way of capturing what economists call the cost of externalities. So every time someone has a toxic emission, there's no cost directly attributed to that. Of course, all of us live less well because of a toxic environment, but no one is charging you for that. And because of that, it's difficult to use economic incentives unless you do the tax thing to get people to change their behavior.
Well, Julianne, lots of food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Economist Julianne Malveaux is president of Bennett College. She spoke with us from WFDD Studios in Greensboro, North Carolina.